Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. New York, this is Democracy Now!
Climate change is here, it is terrifying, and it is just the beginning. The era of global warming has ended, the era of global boiling has arrived.
Temperature records are continuing to be shattered across the globe as July has become the hottest month ever recorded on the planet. More than 170 million people are under a heat alert in the United States. We'll speak to two journalists covering the climate crisis, then to Capitol Hill.
I'm Greg Cassad. I'm the new member of Congress representing the heart of Texas from San Antonio up to Austin, Texas. And I'm on thirst strike. I've been out here over 8 hours now with no water, no food, taking no breaks from the Capitol steps to protest against Governor Abbott taking people's water breaks away from them.
We'll get Congressmember Kassar's response to the White House's new measures to provide workers relief from extreme heat. Then President Biden's designated national monument honoring Emmett Till and his mother, Mamie Till Mobley, on August 28, 1955. 14-year-old Emmett Till was tortured and lynched in Mississippi. We'll speak to Emmett's cousin, who was with him the night of his lynching.
Back then in the darkness, I could never imagine a moment like this. Standing in the light of wisdom, grace, and deliverance.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Federal prosecutors have filed new charges against former President Donald Trump and another one of his aides in the indictment around his mishandling of classified documents. The charges accuse Trump of attempting to, quote, alter, destroy, mutilate, or conceal evidence, unquote, and inducing others to do so. Prosecutors also added a new count under the Espionage Act for showing classified national security materials to visitors to his Bedminster Golf Club. The revised indictment states Trump and Mar-a-Lago property manager Carlos de Oliveira pressured the director of IT at Trump's Florida estate to delete security camera footage so it could not be seen by a federal grand jury. According to the indictment, de Oliveira said, quote, the boss wanted the server deleted. De Oliveira is also accused of lying to federal investigators when he denied having knowledge of boxes of documents stashed at Mar-a-Lago. Prosecutors contend de Oliveira oversaw and even helped move the boxes alongside Trump aide Walt Nauta, who has already been indicted. This superseding indictment is not to be confused with a possible third indictment against Trump related to his efforts to overturn the 2020 election, for which Trump's lawyers met with special counsel Jack Smith's office Thursday. New climate data show July is on track to become the hottest month in human history, with global temperatures rising to about 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels. On Thursday, the head of the World Meteorological Organization said climate action is not a luxury, but a must, while UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres scolded world leaders over inaction on the climate.
Climate change is here. It is terrifying, and it is just the beginning. The era of global warming has ended. The era of global boiling has arrived. The air is unbreathable, the heat is unbearable, and the level of fossil fuel profits and climate inaction is unacceptable.
The UN's warning came as hundreds of wildfires fueled by record heat continue to burn out of control around the Mediterranean. In Algeria, Croatia, France, Greece, Italy, Portugal, Spain, Tunisia, and Turkey. in China. Typhoon Doksuri made landfall today in the southeastern Fujian province, sparking fires, downing power lines, and shuttering schools and businesses. On Thursday, the storm lashed southern Taiwan after battering the northern Philippines, where it killed at least 39 people. Here in the United States, over 170 million people are under extreme heat alerts as sweltering temperatures spread across the country. On Thursday, President Biden announced a series of measures to tackle the impacts of the extreme heat.
We should be protecting workers from hazardous conditions, and we will. And those states where they do not, I'm going to be calling them out, where they refuse to protect these workers in this awful heat.
But Biden made no mention of the fossil fuel industry's role in the climate crisis and continued to ignore calls from climate activists and scientists to declare a climate emergency. We'll speak with Congressmember Greg Kassar, who went on a thirst strike this week in Washington, D.C. In more climate news, the Supreme Court has cleared the way for construction of the contested Mountain Valley pipeline to resume. The court on Thursday lifted a halt on a section of the project that had been issued by a lower court earlier this month after a challenge by environmental groups. Leaders of Niger's military have declared their support for the mutinous officers who declared a coup Wednesday against the nation's democratically elected president, Mohamed Bazoum. 2 days after members of his own presidential guard deposed him, President Bazoum has refused to step down. It's not clear who's currently running Niger's government. On Thursday, supporters of the coup set fire to the headquarters of Bazoum's governing party. Meanwhile, The Intercept reports a leader of the attempted coup was trained by the U.S. military at the army base formerly known as Fort Benning, named after a Confederate general, which was recently renamed Fort Moore. Just last month, coup leader and Brigadier General Musa Salo Barmo met with the head of U.S. Army Special Operations Command, Lieutenant General Jonathan Braga, at a U.S. drone base in Niger. African officers trained by the U.S. military have taken part in 11 coups in West Africa since 2008. The World Health Organization is warning of a growing health crisis for the 3.4 million people forced to flee fighting in Sudan, with rising rates of infectious diseases reported among displaced populations. Heavy fighting continues to rage in the capital, Khartoum, where airstrikes and artillery fire have killed at least 16 civilians this week. In Sudan's western Darfur region, a leader of the Masalit community says more than 10,000 people have been killed in the past 2 months. More than 300,000 people, the vast majority of the Masalit, have fled across the border into neighboring Chad. Refugees describe a harrowing journey to escape attacks by militias and fighters with the rapid support forces.
I've been here for 13 days, and the people we left behind were killed in their homes. There are others who are trapped there, and the road remains unsafe. If there are three or four people, they'll kill them and take their belongings.
Russian President Vladimir Putin welcomed African leaders to St. Petersburg for the annual Africa-Russia summit, coming just days after the Kremlin pulled out of the Black Sea grain deal that allowed safe passage of shipments of food and fertilizer from Ukraine. Heads of state from 17 African countries joined this year's gathering, down from 43 African leaders who attended in 2019. Putin said Russia will be able to replace Ukrainian grain exports and promise free shipments of food to six African nations.
Our country can replace Ukrainian grain both commercially and as a free aid to the poorest countries in Africa, especially as we are again expecting a record harvest this year.
Russian President Putin also pledged to consider a peace plan from African leaders to end the Ukraine war. Among those spotted on the sidelines of the summit was the leader of the Wagner Group of Russian mercenaries, Yevgeny Prigozhin, who was photographed shaking hands with a senior ambassador from the Central African Republic. It was the first time Prigozhin has appeared publicly inside Russia since he led a failed revolt against Russia's military in June. The United States Senate has approved the largest military budget in history. Its passage sets up a partisan clash with a Republican majority in the House of Representatives, which narrowly approved a military budget packed with anti-abortion and anti-LGBTQIA amendments. On Thursday, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer called passage of the Senate's $886 billion National Defense Authorization Act, quote, a glimmer of hope for the American people.
And a bipartisan process is precisely what the American people are yearning for. In a fractured Congress, Democrats, Republicans coming together to provide something as critical as our national defense.
Just 11 senators voted against the record military budget, 6 Democrat, 4 Republican, and Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders. Senators overwhelmingly rejected an amendment offered by Sanders that would have slashed the military budget by 10%. Ahead of the vote, Sanders said the U.S. should prioritize spending on health care and social programs over a bloated military budget.
Unbelievably, our life expectancy is actually declining. Our child care system is dysfunctional. Millions of parents unable to find affordable sites for their kids. We have a major housing crisis. 600,000 Americans are homeless. And, oh, yes, the planet is on fire, and the world we are leaving future generations will be increasingly unhealthy. But somehow, we never have enough money to address those crises.
In El Salvador, human rights advocates are warning of severe due process violations after lawmakers approved the use of mass trials for the tens of thousands of people who've been arrested under President Nayib Bukele's brutal crackdown on gangs. Salvadoran officials said up to 900 defendants could be prosecuted at one time. El Salvador has been under a state of exception for 16 months, suspending several constitutional protections and leading to the arbitrary detention of over 70,000 people without access to legal representation or fair trials. Meanwhile, Honduras is planning to build an island prison to detain hundreds of suspected gang leaders. This comes after President Xiomara Castro earlier this month approved another extension of a state of emergency that's been in place since last year to tackle gang violence. In Ecuador, authorities have recovered the remains of people killed during a prison riot over the weekend in the city of Guayaquil. At least 31 people were reported dead, but the toll could be higher. Ecuador's prison system has been plagued with violence and abuse, with prisoners facing overcrowded and squalid conditions. President Guillermo Lasso has declared a state of emergency in Ecuadorian prisons. Over 400 people have died in prison riots in Ecuador since 2021. Back in the United States, data shows the rate of gun suicides among black teens has topped the rate among white teens for the first time, as gun suicides reached an all-time high last year. The data compiled by the Centers for Disease Control also shows black children and teens have a gun homicide rate 20 times higher than white children and teens. Guns remain the leading cause of death for children and teens, with the rate of gun deaths among minors soaring by 87% over the last decade. Last year, over 48,000 people in the United States died from guns, an average of one person every 11 minutes. And in Texas, the Houston Independent School District's eliminating librarian positions at 28 schools in the upcoming school year and will replace some libraries with so-called team centers, essentially disciplinary centers for students. The widely blasted move comes after state Republicans forcibly took over the Houston Independent School District earlier this year. Those most affected will be children of color in lower-income areas. Meanwhile, two Texas bookstores and three national bookseller associations have sued over a Texas bill requiring private booksellers to rate books based on levels of, quote, appropriateness, and banning, quote, sexually explicit material from libraries. Valerie Kohler is the owner of the Blue Willow Bookshop in Houston, a co-plaintiff in the lawsuit.
We're not going to read them all. And for us to have to rate them, I think, sends a message to the librarians and to the students that you're allowed to read this, you're not allowed to read that.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at the climate crisis as temperature records continue to be shattered across the globe. On Thursday, the World Meteorological Organization announced July is on pace to be the hottest month ever recorded on Earth. Here in the United States, 170 million people are under heat alert. On Thursday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the world has entered the age of global boiling.
For vast parts of North America, Asia, Africa, and Europe, it's a cruel summer. For the entire planet, it is a disaster. And for scientists, it is unequivocal. Humans are to blame. All this is entirely consistent with predictions and repeated warnings. The only surprise is the speed of the change. Climate change is here, it is terrifying, and it is just the beginning. The era of global warming has ended, the era of global boiling has arrived. The air is unbreathable, the heat is unbearable, and the level of fossil fuel profits and climate inaction is unacceptable. Leaders must lead. No more hesitancy, no more excuses, no more waiting for the others to move first. There is simply no more time for that. It is still possible to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius and avoid the very worst of climate change, but only with dramatic, immediate climate action.
Here in the United States, President Biden unveiled new measures Thursday to combat the crisis, but resisted calls to declare a climate emergency.
I don't think anybody can deny the impact of climate change anymore. There used to be a lot of time when I first got here, a lot of people said, oh, it's not a problem. Well, I don't know anybody. I shouldn't say that. I don't know anybody who honestly believes climate change is not a serious problem. Just take a look at the historic floods in Vermont and California earlier this year. Droughts and hurricanes that are growing more frequent and intense. Wildfires spreading a smoky haze for thousands of miles, worsening air quality. The record temperatures, and I mean record, are now affecting more than 100 million Americans.
We're joined now by two guests. Darna Noor is fossil fuels and climate reporter at The Guardian. Her recent piece, Biden Announces New Measures to Protect Americans from Extreme Heat. Her new investigation, Project 2025, plan to dismantle U.S. climate policy for next Republican president. We're also joined by David Wallace Wells, writer for New York Times Opinion and columnist for The New York Times Magazine, who's been writing about climate change, how it's accelerating. His latest piece is headlined A Grim Climate Lesson from the Canadian Wildfires. He's also author of the book The Uninhabitable Earth. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! David, let's begin with you. If you can respond to what President Biden announced yesterday, and does it go far enough?
I think the short answer is no, it doesn't go far enough. We're talking about a really dramatic summer here in the United States. I think many Americans are living with some amount of climate fear, 170 million Americans under extreme heat advisories. And what the president offered was a pretty meek rhetorical gesture mixed with some very small policy measures. I'm glad that he's speaking about climate as opposed to being silent as he has been for a long time. But to my mind, he's not meeting the American public where they are at all.
And Darna Noor, your response, you wrote a whole piece on this.
I would have to agree. I agree with David that I think most of what we saw was rhetorical gesture from the Biden administration. I did speak with experts who described some of the steps that he took as positive. For instance, rolling out new funding to help cities plant trees to make sure that people can have shade in extreme heat, making sure that cities can fund cooling centers, improving weather forecasting. But as you mentioned earlier, Amy, what Biden did not mention at all was the term fossil fuels. He didn't really say anything about the need to end the fossil fuel economy. He certainly did not declare a climate emergency, which is something that activists have been pushing him to do for years at this point, and could unlock a number of powers to help him take on the crisis without congressional approval. And so I think that what we saw from Biden was, you know, really awareness raising and some kind of modest policies, but nothing that takes on the scale of the crisis that we're seeing right now.
He also ordered the Department of Labor to put a hazard alert for outdoor workplaces. Darna, can you talk more about this and the other measures around workplaces? Could he also mandate paid water breaks and workplace protection gears like canopies of shade, fans, mist machines, etc.?
The heat hazard alert that Biden issued yesterday was interesting. In one sense, it was unprecedented. It was the first heat hazard alert that will go out to employers across the nation, sort of reminding them of the rights that workers have on the job and the ways to best protect workers from extreme heat. But I think what it really also made many experts think about is the fact that his Department of Labor is still working right now to craft a heat standard that would do much more to protect workers. Last year, the Department of Labor said that they were working on one of these standards. Officials have been talking about it for something like 50 years. And that would drastically expand, you know, the ability for the government to do things like, you know, recommend or even mandate water breaks or shade breaks and things like this. But that process could take years to complete. And so I think that what we saw, again, was, you know, an attempt to use the powers that already exist. But I think what experts would say is that we really need to expand those powers in a huge way.
David Wallace Wells, we recently interviewed a TV meteorologist in Iowa who just quit because, as he reported, the connection between weather, which is what so many people tune into on radio and television just to find out what the weather is, but when he made that connection between weather and climate change, he got death threats. You're constantly talking about the connection between weather, climate change, and your most recent piece is about the Canadian wildfires and how they connect to all this. Can you explain?
Well, global heating produces much more intense fire conditions. In Canada, it's produced a totally unprecedented fire season. We've already seen more than 25 million acres burn in Canada, which is 2.5 times the size of the largest American wildfire season in modern history. Those fires are still burning. They're still burning out of control. And to some extent, this is actually by design. Canada is so large that firefighters can't possibly suppress those fires when they begin. It's understood to be better forest management now, better fire policy, to let fires burn so that forests can regenerate on their own. But when you're dealing with fire conditions like climate change has created, that means some unbelievably large and intense fires producing huge amounts of carbon emissions, in this case probably more carbon this year than Canada will produce from all of its other industrial and economic activities combined, and also the smoke that we're so familiar with in the U.S., and which is not just bothering cities in Canada and the U.S., but even across the Atlantic in Europe. Now, I think when most people see news events about, you know, news coverage of heat waves or wildfires, I don't think it's that hard for them to make the connection to climate change these days. I think the jumps that are a little bit harder and would be a little bit more helpful for more people to make is the jump from climate change to the question of climate action, why we're not doing more, and who is standing in the way. So when I see, you know, when I see news coverage of extreme heat, you know, extreme heat warnings, I don't worry too much that we don't put the word climate change in those headlines. I think most people understand that. What I think fewer people understand is why we're not doing more to protect ourselves against this really quite dramatic threat, which is coming at us, as you say, considerably faster than we anticipated even just a few years ago.
And talk about what those kind of measures would look like. Again, as you say, you talk about not only the wildfires across Canada, as well as Greece, Algeria, and dozens of other places around the world.
Well, I mean, the short answer is to limit all of these impacts. We need to reduce carbon emissions very rapidly. And while we have had an incredibly impressive renewable rollout over the last couple of years, all of the graphs are pointing way up. The next decade looks much more promising for renewable energy than most advocates even believed was possible just a few years ago. Nevertheless, they've barely dented, if they've dented at all, the emissions that we're producing from fossil fuel generation. So we haven't actually reduced the share of global power production that comes from fossil fuels from this remarkable renewable rollout. We're just using those renewables to add to our power capacity. And that's really, you know, the change that we need to make. We need to be producing so much renewables now that we can actually draw down fossil fuels and draw them down relatively rapidly, rather than simply using them to supplement our consumption patterns and power production. And unfortunately, we haven't really seen a sign of that. At best, it looks like we're going to be looking at sort of a plateau for emissions over the rest of this decade. And we know from all of the scientific warnings that's simply inadequate if we have any hope of meeting some of our more ambitious climate targets.
In a moment, David, I want to ask you about what would be the most effective legislation in the United States to deal with climate change. But Darna Noor, I wanted to first go to your piece. If you can explain what Project 2025 is and what you found in your investigation.
Absolutely. So Project 2025 is essentially a group of dozens of right-wing organizations. We're talking about think tanks, publications, and the like. And it was convened by the Heritage Foundation, which is, I think, in the climate world, very well known for promoting climate denial for decades, and for even longer, promoting this sort of anti-regulatory stance. So these groups came together in an attempt, essentially, to advise whoever the next president is, if that person's a Republican. So any Republican who takes office in next year's presidential election. This is the second time that the Heritage Foundation has led the creation of a sort of transition plan aimed at a Republican president. In the early 80s, we saw the Heritage Foundation create one of these plans that actually went on to have a huge influence on the Reagan administration and was framed as a sort of way of taking on the out-of-control regulatory state. And in this particular iteration, there's a lot of focus in their new transition plan on unmaking environmental regulations. I'm happy to talk more about this, but there's a number of previous Trump appointees who have written essentially proposals to undo the many powers of the federal administration, from the EPA to the Department of the Interior, all in an attempt to sort of lessen the federal authority to regulate fossil fuels and essentially to boost those polluting industries.
You know, it's interesting. Polls show now that Biden and Trump, even though he was indicted again yesterday, are neck and neck in the polls for president. You talk about the Department of the Interior part of the plan in this 2025 plan being written by William Perry Pendley. You note he controversially led the Bureau of Land Management under President Trump and worked to eliminate drilling regulations. Talk more specifically and name names.
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, William Perry Pendley very controversially led the Bureau of Land Management under President Trump, controversially because he was actually never confirmed by the Senate. This was the case for a number of Trump appointees. And he also was known before he had a role in the Trump administration for writing this book called Sagebrush Rebel that was really in praise of Ronald Reagan, of Ronald Reagan's anti-regulatory sort of agenda. It's unsurprising to see his name in a sort of proposal that's aimed at, ending the ability for federal regulations to have any real impact on the environment. Previous reporting from E&E News, from Scott Waldman there, found that Mandy Gunasekera had written another chapter focused on remaking the EPA, really focused on shrinking its authority, both by laying off staff, by cutting budgets, with an especially big focus on sort of cutting environmental programs like environmental justice programming and public outreach programming. Another name that was in the proposal was Bernard McAmey, who wrote a chapter on the Department of Energy, again, sort of in an attempt to say we should shrink the authority of the Department of Energy. He previously served as an advisor to Ted Cruz, and before that, he led this far-right organization called the Texas Public Policy Institute, or Texas Public Policy Foundation, rather, that really aims to undo environmental regulation and fight renewable energy at the state level. And so we're really seeing, I think, a who's who of the far-right in this attempt to, not only sort of be in the next president's ear if they're a Republican, but also, sort of recommend personnel and say, hey, here's who you should staff up with.
What role does billionaire Charles Koch play in this project, Darna?
So the Heritage Foundation, who, again, are the far right foundation that sort of convened this group, Project 2025, has historically had ties, financial ties to the Koch brothers. Who are, of course, billionaires who made their fortune in fossil fuels and related industries. The Heritage Foundation is also a member of the State Policy Network, which is a sort of coalition of these extreme right-wing groups that have targeted regulation, especially climate-focused regulation in states for many years. And I think, I would just say, I guess it's no surprise that an organization with ties to to people who have made such a great fortune in the industries that are that must be regulated in order to take on the climate crisis are, have historically been tied to a group that is trying to push that agenda to the presidential level.
As we begin to wrap up, I wanted to ask David Wallace Wells to respond to what Dorna is describing right now, and also talk about what needs exactly to be done. I mean, we're speaking today, the day after the Supreme Court has just okayed, cleared the way for construction of the contested Mountain Valley pipeline to resume, lifting a halt on a section of the project that had been issued by a lower court earlier this month after a challenge by environmental groups.